On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Good evening and welcome. Another broadcast week begins as we move into the meat of November. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. A little internet radio experiment that began 7 years and change ago. The four score and 7 years minus the four score. In an attempt to see if there wasn't a better way to exchange information within a radio-style format. What we came up with is a little something that we call conversation radio. It's long form. You're not going to hear any commercials on this program for Buy Gold Now or mattresses that were formulated because of our forays into space. No, there won't be any vacuum cleaner ads talking about the bowling balls that they can drop on those mattresses. What we have here is conversation, occasionally punctuated by a little bit of music here and there. But the single most important part of this whole experiment is you. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. The Horn is available on a wide variety of internet platforms, including TuneIn Radio and Tuner Internet Radio, Stitcher Internet Radio, Dar.fm, and Streama.com, as well as Roku. The podcasts are available at WhiteRoseSociety.org under the Horn's subdomain. Head On with Bob Kincaid. The podcast address is there, and you can also get the podcast on iTunes. So we can go with you pretty much anywhere you need to go. And by all means, we encourage you to take us along. Tell us about the world where you are. Tell us what you're thinking. What's moving and inspiring and annoying you. Because this really is an exchange of information and ideas and feelings and that is entirely unscripted, and the greatest value to it is not so much improv but simply candor. And candor is something one seldom finds in the for-profit media. We try to raise about $150 a night to keep all of this going, a veritable pittance compared to, well, I was talking with someone over the weekend, way back before it swirled round and round and down the drain. Air America was going through something on the order of $80,000 a day back then. And The Horn back then was putting out almost as much live original programming as Air America was on what wouldn't even be a fraction of that. We had programming that started at 10 a.m. and didn't wrap up until midnight. Sometimes 1 a.m. Pretty cool, huh? It wasn't sustainable, though, because people have to earn a living. But at any rate, we're still here. And so we will be trying to raised that $150 this evening. We didn't raise it on Friday. And Dr. John has asked me to begin the program this evening by announcing his $50 challenge. He will match the first $50 to come in. So your $10 contribution becomes a $20 contribution. Your $20 becomes a $40, you know, up to $50. So if Dr. John's challenge gets met, we will be two-thirds of the way to where we need to be to get the show funded for this evening. So Dr. John's challenge is on the table. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. And the snail mail address is at headonradionetwork.com as well. I'll repeat it now for leaping for the checkbook. Checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid. Bob Kincaid doesn't get the money. They should be made payable to The Horn or Head On Communications and mailed to 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, Personal Mailbox 318, Beckley, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. And thank you very much in advance. Now, Randy in Pennsylvania reminding, fundraising time, you're behind. Oh, yes, we are. Yes, we are. We haven't even changed at our good friend and longtime supporter Tom's suggestion. We moved to $150 a night in our fundraising efforts, and he suggested moving the monthly goal to $3,000. We haven't even done that. If you go to headonradionetwork.com, you will find by the little bar graph widget there that we are, as far as monthly fundraising goes, we are at $665. That's about four shows into the year, and it's the 12th day of November. So we are in a significant hole, to say the least. Today is Veterans Day. Once upon a time, the 11th day of November was marked as Armistice Day, the end of the war to end all wars, which ended on the 11th day of the 11th month in the 11th hour. Those who were there said the silence that then prevailed was stunning to behold, shocking even, for someone used to the hellish cacophony of war. My father and my mother told me the story of Armistice Day. And to the very end of their lives, they spoke of the 11th of November as Armistice Day. It was later transferred over to be a day for the honoring of all veterans, which is in itself fine. But there is something in me that wants to remember that war to make the world safe for democracy. When she was a little girl, my mother and her older brother, my uncle, who at 92 is still alive, and who was a carrier fighter ace in the Pacific in the Second World War, in marking Armistice Day, read what had by then become a most famous poem. My mother, or my uncle, I believe, read the first poem. My mother read the second, standing in the window of their little wood frame schoolhouse, not far from here. It's gone now. Back up the hill a little ways from where the grade school now stands. Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, M.D., who lived from 1872 to 1918 and served in the Canadian Army, wrote, "In Flanders fields the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe, to you from falling hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields." It was a generation that got its heart broken in a war that ultimately was waged for the benefit of the 1%. There is little now to suggest that it was fought for any other reason, regardless of the pronouncements of Woodrow Wilson about making the safe, making the world safe for democracy, or making it the war to end all wars. That idea didn't really hold out a generation, maybe about a half of one, maybe about a third of a generation it lasted. And the seeds of yet another horror were sown from the train car where the armistice was signed. The other poem that I always associate with Armistice Day was written by Wilfred Owen. Like the author of In Flanders Fields, he did not live to see the peace. He wrote a poem called Dulce et Decorum Est, far more visual, as poetry goes, than the charge laid upon the living by the dead in Flanders Fields. Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and toward our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of disappointed shells that dropped behind. Gas! Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time, but someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you, too, could pace behind the wagon we flung him in, and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil's sick of sin. If you could hear, at every jolt, the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. Sweet and proper it is to die for country.
dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. And of course, they yet remain lessons unlearned. They were not learned a scant 18 years later, 19, 20, 21 years later, they were not learned. And so a whole new generation, that generation two of whom stood in a schoolhouse window reading In Flanders Fields and responding with America answers. Would get to go and repeat that theater in the abattoir at which what transpired between 1914 and 1918 hinted. Lather, rinse, repeat. And here we are. It's the second decade of the 21st century, as we so often note. And great fools still think that great questions are best solved from the muzzle of a gun. We've learned more and more over the weekend about General David Petraeus and his fling. Somehow or another, a little snippet of Dr. Strangelove slipped into the consciousness over the weekend. I saw that scene of George C. Scott playing General Buck Turgidson. When he was on the phone with his sweetie. I can't talk to you right now, honey. I'm in the war room. My president needs me. Now you just relax and lay back there, and old Bucky'll be back there before you can say blast off. The right wing is beginning to have a hissy. But what's new? Hissies are what the right wing does best, you know, outside of lying. And we will watch it develop as all manner of insanity and lunacy is propagated. General Turgidson, Petraeus, for all of his lauding as being a man of honor and decency, proved in the end to have none. 37 years married, but decided he wouldn't get caught because, you know, he was a smart guy. Wouldn't get caught. He married the daughter of the man who had been the superintendent of West Point when he was a student there. She was a formidable intellect in her own right. She gave him two children, a son and a daughter. His son is a commissioned officer in the Army now, having graduated from MIT. She herself was a scholar. And for reasons incomprehensible, Who knows? But this will get ugly before it gets good.
because apparently we're going to have investigations of investigations of investigations. The right wing is in an uproar. And look who's at the center. Why, it's Eric Leave Britney Alone Cantor. You remember Eric Cantor, House Majority Leader, the one who couldn't be bothered to attend the proceedings of the House of Representatives because he had a fundraising party going on at a Britney Spears concert at, the Verizon Center in Washington, D.C.? Yeah, that Eric Cantor. Leave Britney alone! Information came to Cantor's office, and Cantor passed it along, but not to his president, and not even, and this is actually kind of important, not even to his Speaker of the House. Oh, that Mr. Cantor, he is a wily one. He wants to be speaker so badly he can taste it. Sad, really, in a way. They pride themselves on that honor code at West Point. And the Army itself prides itself on some modicum of honor. And David Petraeus took that honor, and you could say that he, well, no, we won't say what he did with it, will we? Too early in the program for that. It is, you see, more and Monday on the horn. That day that we reserve for a special and profound manifestations of stupidity of the right-wing variety. Do please remember that General Petraeus is and was a registered Republican. Can you imagine? Oh, however bad this is, it would be a million times worse if he'd been a registered Democrat. You see? Sean Hannity might very well be having a baby on air. Got a note from our buddy Tosh in regard to the Petraeus business. He said, first, it's clear to me that former Director of Central Intelligence General Petraeus achieved the former state, the state of being former, because he tried to hide his extramarital affair. Knowing what I do with this type of clearance, it is not necessarily the mistaken act that loses a person their clearance. It is lying about mistakes. When I first got my clearance, I was in the throes of losing my driver's license because I had received and not fought a 5-point speeding ticket. I got my clearance because I told the investigator about the ticket. Side note for conservatives, conspiracy watchers, if the Obama administration campaign had used this misdeed to lean on the director of Central Intelligence to give favorable testimony, like that there was 25 DF and CIA operators in Benghazi who entered the engagement with the rioter and militia, as was reported within 25 minutes of the start of hostilities, and a second force was en route when the ambassador died at that facility, there is no way they would have outed him. They would have quietly relieved him of command and let him quietly and secretly retire to the private sector. There is no cover-up. Then Tosh asked this question, upon which we may ponder. No person shall be held to answer for a capital. This is from the Fifth Amendment. This is the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject to the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. That line about except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia is, along the way, what gives rise to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is wildly different from what would be construed as standard civilian justice. A whole lot less rights in the Uniform Code of Military Justice than there is in the Constitution of the United States. You sign a lot of those away when you sign on the dotted line and agree to put on the costume. Interestingly, it is procedure under the Uniform Code of Military Justice that yielded up news last week of a change in the status of Bradley Manning. I don't know if you caught this or not, or if anybody, maybe somebody else has already talked about it at length. But lawyers for Bradley Manning announced that he was voluntarily entering guilty pleas to lesser charges. It was not part of a plea agreement. He wanted to go in and plead guilty to what he thought he was guilty of doing because he felt like he was guilty of doing something. I have not read the follow-up story, so if you know it, please enlighten me. But that was announced late last week, and I thought it rather interesting because it was not part of a plea bargain. Interestingly, he also decided to forego his right to be tried by a jury comprised of officers, and instead allow the judge himself or herself, I don't know, to sit as the finder of fact, the trier of fact, and the trier of law. Anyway, Tosh has another question. He says, the bold text, that business about accepting cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger. He says, that's what caught my eye. Would this provide legal constitutional justification for the Osama bin Laden execution and the partially judicial execution of the American citizen who had renounced America and served in Al-Qaeda, which organizationally, they aren't a nation that can't have done this nationally, declared war on the U.S.? Perhaps. Perhaps. It does not, however, answer the question about the juvenile, his son, who we killed extrajudicially, without due process, of whom we knew of no enunciation of allegiance or any statement of allegiance to Al-Qaeda. He just simply had to be there with his daddy because that's the way sometimes things work out. And he got dead. No charges. No trial. No prosecution, no defense, no jury, just an executioner. 16 years old. That is extremely disturbing. Tosh says, it's kind of like the battles of the Civil War. Once the officer in charge of the Union Army was certain they were facing CSA forces, all the men in the CSA forces who didn't surrender were subject to battlefield execution, you know, death in battle, which is true. But it must be remembered that while I don't like nya-nya-nya-nya kind of stuff, the South started it. They openly rebelled and openly waged war against the United States of America. It was, in fact, a four-year-long act of continuing treason. Posh says, I know Lincoln took plenty of liberties with our civil liberties. That he did. But I don't recall hearing that the death of CSA forces in battle constituted non-judicial execution. No, you won't. Some of the saddest bits of history out of the Civil War and its aftermath lie instead in what happened after, with, for instance, the execution of Mary Surratt, even after the Supreme Court had issued a writ stopping the execution. Government killed her anyway. Interesting. Interesting. Now, like I said, it's Moran Monday. I'm going to leave the circus music off for this evening. And just jump straight to the Morans because, well, we've got a lot of them. A couple of them came from John, who put the Moran Monday challenge on the table. He'll match the first $50 that come in so that his 50 plus yours become 100. John sent one in that just sort of, well, made my head spin just a little bit. I don't understand what it is with Duke University and its lacrosse team. They had a problem years back. And now they've got another one. The link I has headlined, until a few minutes ago, Duke's official site featured a women's lacrosse player wearing blackface. If you go to deadspin.com, you'll likely find it. Just look up Duke and black Duke women's lacrosse blackface. You'll see her there. It's a Halloween photo of some sort. Let's see, we've got a little ballerina. Some unidentifiables, and then a white girl in blackface. The article comes from GoDuke.com, the official site for Duke University Athletics. Oh, I'm sorry, they were the little rascals. Oh, I get it. Yeah, okay, there's Alfalfa. I didn't know the little rascals. Oh, that must be Darla in the ballerina tutu. Okay. They dressed up like the little rascals for Halloween, and as Tom Lay, writing at Deadspin, notes, and wouldn't you know it, the one who dressed up as Buckwheat decided to put on blackface. It's got a couple of bonuses along with it, this story. The photo was taken at the home of the lacrosse team's coach. It's been pulled and replaced with something less innocuous, absent the Buckwheat character. Jesus. Really? We haven't figured that out yet. We haven't yet figured out that nowhere in America is it a good idea to appear in blackface. Isn't it funny how you don't see not a lot of white face or pink face or flesh-colored crayon face going on out there? But blackface, yeah. Because you can't have the little rascals unless you got Buckwheat. It's getting Nah, it's not getting its bin. A little bit weird out there. Morons. As the writer of the blog post at Deadspin put it, "Oh, Duke Sports, you'll always be number one in making the rest of America cringe." They've got the single most cringe-worthy basketball coach in the country. Ew, little weasel. But blackface? In 2012, Mama and Daddy must be so proud of their little pumpkin. Don't you reckon? That's just how they raised her. Isn't it inspiring? Go to a prestigious institution like Duke, play some lacrosse, and go get your blackface on for Halloween. I mean, if you can't do it on Halloween, when can you, really? How about never? How about there's some things that the dead past should just be allowed to bury? Kind of like the British royals showing up at Halloween parties and costume parties dressed as Nazis. You know, there's just some things you don't do. I don't care if it's Halloween or not. You don't show up in blackface, you don't show up as Nazis, and you don't show up as Klansmen. But see, that's what happens when your white privilege is sewn on and embedded so tight that you can't get around it or past it or above it or below it or through it. It's just there. When she was sitting there in front of the mirror, blacking her face, this is the question I have. At any point in time, did any little, still, small voice say, maybe this isn't a good idea? I don't think it did. And I think that if it did, there was a cacophony of other voices saying, "Nah, this is just funny. Nobody will ever know. Internet? What internet?" Because nothing says funny like blackface. I guess we can just be grateful that it was a Little Rascals party. Otherwise, she would have come as Aunt Jemima, right? Welcome to America in the 21st century. Special, huh? Oh, but we do. We've got morons out there. I have long thought that workers in the coal industry here in Appalachia were pretty well morons, but oh, goodness me. It turns out there are the coal morality has done gone global. This story comes from news.com.au. See, when you're in the mining business, it's very dangerous. You know, working around high explosives, maybe working in tunnels deep under the ground where extremely hazardous and explosive gases sometimes gather. And you really want to be on your best game when you're down there. So maybe you don't want to be twisted. And maybe there are laws that say that you can't go in the hole twisted. And the bad things happen if you pee in a bottle and it comes back, opiated or cannabinoidal or the boozed or coked or, you know, and they've all got different half-lives, I understand. Well, guess what? In Australia now, for between $30 and $95, depending on how much what you want in the way of quality, if you're a coal miner, you no longer have to worry about getting, you know, maybe going out on Friday after work and getting a little sideways and having a problem when you come in on Monday. Nope. Here's what the ad says. Contains all the ingredients normally found in urine and is balanced for pH, specific gravity, creatinine, and other urine characteristics, enabling buyers to pass drug tests. For between $30 and $95 per kit, most of them also come with heat pads to keep the phony baloney pee at body temperature. And in case anybody's watching, the Sweet Pea brand and Whizinator brand also come with prosthetic penises. This isn't just the coal industry, of course. It's the iron ore industry. It's all kinds of mining. Out in West Pilbara region of Western Australia, the police say they are increasingly finding the products during drug raids, usually involving people employed in mining. Detective Inspector Ben Carroll, acting Detective Inspector Ben Carroll, is the Central Queensland Regional Coordinator. He said that the intelligence they're getting, police intelligence from inside the mining camps, says that fake pee is becoming more and more prevalent. We've noticed a rise in this sort of behavior. Rise. He's a funny one, Ben Carroll. We've noticed a rise in this sort of behavior aimed at defeating the testing regime. They all know about it in the industry. It's very simple to get hold of. When fake pee is outlawed, only outlaws will have fake pee. It's not illegal to either sell or possess this stuff. Gotta wonder if any of these people work for that awful, what's her name, Gina what? That awful woman who said that people are poor because they're sitting around drinking and smoking too much? Smoking what, Gina? Yeah. So to review, instead of simply abiding by the rules, for which they are handsomely paid, they want to be handsomely paid and bag the rules, then why not get out of the business? No, see, that's just the free market operating, isn't it? Just the free market out there answering a need. The unseen hand of the market writing and having writ moving on. No, we got Moran's O'Plenty. A Moran nomination going out this evening to Navy SEAL Team 6. And this is just going to make you proud. Well, it will if you're like a card-carrying member, subscriber of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, or you get the Milton Friedman newsletter or something like that. It'll make y'all proud. You know, it was Navy SEAL Team 6 that took out Osama bin Laden, of course. We've all heard about that. Six Navy SEAL Team 6 members have already been punished. Four more are still under investigation for divulging classified information. We've all seen the movies, you know, the spy thrillers. Some guy walks by with a piece of chalk and puts a chalk mark on the mailbox, and then, you know, goes to the drop-off point and hides the stuff in the, right, the microfilm. Because our military secrets are really, really secret. And we don't want them just getting into anybody's hands. you know, like, for instance, when surveillance technology got into the hands of the Chinese back during the Bush 1 administration, when our spy plane was shot down, and George Bush said, don't make me say I'm sorry, or I'll have to say I'm sorry twice. And he really did. He apologized twice while letting the Chinese have our secret technology. I'm sorry, seven members, SEAL Team 6, four more under investigation. Because they use secret stuff, fancy-ass weapons, things like that. I mean, they don't use the average stuff that we give to your ordinary infantry type. For all we know, the shit like death rays or flying cars. Who doesn't know? But here's the fun part. Here's the fun part of the SEAL teams selling out. SEAL Team 6 is having sold out American technology. They didn't sell out to the Russians. Hell, they didn't even sell out to the Israelis. And the Israelis are always looking to buy, too, because they're such good allies. Didn't sell out to the Russians. Didn't sell out to the Israelis. Didn't sell out to the Cubans or the Venezuelans or even the dreaded Iranians. Oh, hell no. They sold out. No kidding. To a video game maker. It's a fascinating little story. The seven who have already been busted received a letter of reprimand and a partial forfeiture of pay for 2 months. We don't know what percentage of pay was forfeited. We don't know what was in the letter of reprimand that was put in their files. We don't know how much they were paid. The story I've got from the Houston Chronicle says the video game project, and from the Associated Press, the video game project and the SEAL's connection to it came to light as a result of the investigation into a book by Matt Bissonette, a retired member of SEAL Team 6, who participated in the Osama bin Laden raid, and then published a tell-all book about the raid. Yeah. Here's what's funny, though. You don't know the members of SEAL Team 6. I don't know the members of SEAL Team 6, the names. Very few people do. But somehow or another, the folks who manufacture and sell for oodles of profit the Medal of Honor video game series for Xbox and PlayStation. Found out how to get through to SEAL Team 6. Dude, you know what they gave me? I'm going to get an advanced copy of Medal of Honor Warfighter, and I'm getting the skins pack for free and the online upgrades. Sweet, dude! Hyah! No, it's not like selling out to the Russians or the Israelis or the Iranians or the Cubans or the Venezuelans or the Chinese. In a way, it's worse. They sold out for nothing more than profit. And they get to keep their jobs. I'd like to know who put them in touch. Who put the video game manufacturer in touch with SEAL Team 6. Wouldn't you? even if you retire from SEAL Team 6 or other, some other sensitive classified position, one often signs, is compelled to sign, non-disclosure agreements that says you'll keep your trap shut. Rear Admiral Sean Pybus is the Naval Special Warfare Command. He told the remaining after the Matt Bissonnette book came out, he told the remaining active members of SEAL Team 6, he said, hawking tales about a mission and selling other information about SEAL training and operations puts the force and their families at risk. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, they hadn't offered Rear Admiral Pybus, you know, the special upgrade pack with the free skins and the online downloads that not just everybody can get. Now, these guys from the Medal of Honor Warfighter came in to photograph their weapons so that they could render them better, you know, accurately. So anybody who was playing Medal of Honor Warfighter could know what kind of really cool high-tech weaponry SEAL Team 6 was using. Neat. So maybe if you're playing Medal of Honor Warfighter and you're on the other side, you can kind of tailor your own weaponry and armaments to defeat theirs. Or wait, maybe if you're in the real world, you could do the same thing. Gosh, thanks, SEAL Team 6. Clayton, you're incorrigible. Going back to the Australian fake pee story, do the fake pee for girls have free penises also? Incorrigible. It is Moran Monday. And we are not without, we are not without topical material. Do you ever plan to eat a Papa John's pizza again so long as you live? Because I don't! John Schnatter, you remember, what was it, Friday? When we went over, what was his name, Zane Tinkle or Wrinkle or, yeah. The guy who sounds like he gargles with razor blades? Owner of 40-some-odd Applebee's restaurants in the greater New York City area saying, well, we'll never be able to build another one because that Obamacare is going to keep us from doing it and going to keep us from paying. And goddamn, you're communist. You know, that kind of stuff. Well, John, apparently this is a coordinated effort. One could almost say that maybe it ought to fall under the Sherman Act, because so many of these so-called job creators are out there having the same hissy at the same time when none of the so-called Obamacare excesses have even come online yet. You'd almost think that they had, had some sort of conspiracy together to do this. John Schnatter, no, really, that's his name, Schnatter. It's usually what happens to me when I get a bad cold. He runs Papa John's Pizza. And he is just blue in the face at the prospect of increasing pizza prices 14 cents a pie because of Obamacare. You know, the funny thing is, there's nothing that says he has to increase the pie's price by one penny. He could just cut profits a little bit. Because once you get a look at John Schnatter's property, you'll realize that he ain't eating beans. Papa John's International Inc., of which he is CEO, has made him a very wealthy man to the tune of about $240 million. He's got about 3,400 Papa John's stores that he has franchised out. He's number 17 on the Forbes list of the wealthiest people in America, or in the world, rather, under 40 years old. He threw a big party for Willard Romney at his Anchorage, Kentucky manse. The large and over-the-top mansion is owned by founder and CEO of Papa John's, John Schnatter. The house is 40,000 square feet, and it resembles a castle. One interesting feature on this 16-acre estate is the 22-car underground garage. Now we know where Willard got the idea. Complete with an office for valet parking, a car wash, and even a motorized turntable to move limousines. Home also has a state-of-the-art exercise suite and a huge 6,000-square-foot carriage house. Yeah. Delivery driver, on the other hand, working for Papa John's, makes $6.41 per hour and has to make up the rest in tips. You ever seen how people tip the pizza delivery guy? You, me, us, we tend to do a pretty good job of it, as best we can. Not so much a lot of people. There are people trying to feed families by being Papa John's delivery drivers at $6.41 an hour. Dr. John and I were discussing this via email earlier today, trying to figure out why it is that there aren't any progressive chains like Papa John's where we could take our business. And my theory John's question was, damn it, I like Papa John's pizza, so help me. Far and away, my favorite of the big three fast food pizzas, and I think there's kind of a big four. I mean, wouldn't that be Pizza Hut, Papa John's, Domino's, and Little Caesars? But anyway, three or four. Why can't we get progressive chain restaurants? John asks, is it just that we're naturally pushed away from sameness and the lowest common denominator? That sounds so elitist, but maybe it's part of it. Well, I was in a thinking mood earlier this afternoon. And my guess is, the reason there are no progressive massive chain restaurants is because if you want to be progressive and massive and if you want to be massive, a massive chain restaurant, then the first thing you have to be willing to do is screw your workers to the wall. And you can't really do that and hang on to that progressive street cred now, can you? Whereas the growth of a chain restaurant is predicated upon paying low wages, expanding as fast as you possibly can, and plowing all the money into either share dividends or debt service. Consider Godfather's Pizza and Herb Cain. So what we do instead is we look for local places where we can spend our money when we've got to have a pie. I'm lucky here. We have a wonderful local pizza place. It's called Pies and Pints. They serve beer on tap from the local brewery, and they make a damned fine pie. They're pricey, but they're good, and they stay busy. But who doesn't like pizza? I know of only one exception. You know, there's that old saying out there. What do pizza and sex have in common? When it's good, it's great. And even when it's bad, it's pretty good. Well, there's another, there is a chain here called Gino's, G-I-N-O's. G-I-N-O apostrophe S, I guess is what I'm getting at. And it is nothing short of awful. I mean terrible. I mean bad. I mean wouldn't, the dog won't eat it. Obviously, we don't order that. That chain, however, is owned, and I guess he's still around, by a guy who was a Democratic mover and shaker in the West Virginia Senate for years and years and years and years. Not exactly somebody I'd call a progressive, however, or a liberal, and damn sure not a pizza maker. A little bit of email rolling in. Jack in Shreveport asking, forgive me if I'm inappropriate here since I missed part of the coal mining drug testing story, but I couldn't help but find the brand name Whizinator funny. Well, it's supposed to be funny. It struck me as being extra humorous since the name of the device meant to decrease an extra measure of sense and safety in a dangerous environment could also be used as the trade name for a smart pill. And I thought my double entendre of my subject line to this email was a little bit clever, too. Mining urine. He continues, in regard to Papa John's, wouldn't the same burdens or rather advantages apply to Papa John's competitors as well? So what's his freaking problem? Well, that's the thing. It is, it's 14 cents, and if you can find me an American who doesn't think a pie is worth 14 cents extra to make sure that the people making it and delivering it have access to a doctor's office when they need one. Well, I want to see that person. Because I'll bet you somewhere along the way that person has in their background someone who had a similar health care plan when they were younger. But then again, this is the way corporations always respond. I remember when the farm workers in Florida were agitating for a raise in the price in the wage that they were paid in the fee in the tomato fields, and the geniuses over at the Yum Brands, I think it was, because Yum owns Taco Hell, said, "Well, God Almighty, a taco would have to go up a nickel." I guess the American people were supposed to say, a nickel? Well, we just won't come to Taco Hell anymore. We'll go over there to the clown. Right? But see, the 1%, well, as the saying goes, they throw nickels around like manhole covers. We're not part of the 1% because, well, we don't really count those 14 cents and those nickels so much. We wouldn't even notice it. Of course, one never knows what John Schnatter will do. Here's your Obamacare pizza. We had to raise your price by 14 cents. Don't you feel good? Communism! Bill, Mr. Stress, up in Cleveland, noting, Papa John's pizza stinks. I bet Brother Albert will bake one hell of a good pizza, though. Bill says, living in a town, Cleveland, with a lot of ethnic folks, we have many good local restaurants. And that's the trick. Because of that multiplier effect, the money that stays in town goes around and around and around town and winds up doing tremendous good, whereas what you spend with Papa John's or Domino's or whatever just leaves town on the next express, never to return again. Yeah. See what I mean about Moran Monday? We ain't even scratched the surface. Lord God, we have not even scratched the surface. Just because Moran Monday always needs a soupçon of crazy, dangerously crazy. Let's check in. Israeli Defense Force Chief of General Staff Dan Halutz, who is now out there saying, according to the a report in the British Sunday Times, Beth passed this along, the only way to finish off Iran's nuclear program is by using the nuclear option. Ugh. What's interesting is that he followed it up by saying, but I hope Bibi is not mad enough to think about it. Well, General, if he wasn't before, you've got him thinking about it now. Because they've come to the conclusion that the underground facilities where whatever nuclear work is being done, none of which they even know to be directed toward making a nuclear device, bomb, you know, weapon, it's far enough underground that conventional weapons can't get to it. Oopsie. But maybe a nuclear blast, you know, ground level, none of this airburst bullshit. Maybe a nuclear blast at the ground level might. The other reason that they want that the Israelis are interested in having us do their dirty work for them is because their bunker buster bomb is not nearly as good as our bunker buster bomb. Our bunker buster bomb might actually go down to where it needs to go, but we're not selling them to the Israelis, and, well, you get the idea. Only a madman would think about it. The only way to finish off Iran's nuclear program is by using the nuclear option. That, according to Israel's Chief of General Staff. Morans? Well, there are, Tim from LA alerted me to this one. There are citizens in 15 states who have filed petitions with change.org petitioning, for President Obama, Pharaoh-like, to let their people go. Citizens from 15 states, namely Louisiana, Texas, Montana, North Dakota, Indiana, Mississippi, Kentucky, North Carolina, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, New Jersey, Colorado, Oregon, and New York, have all petitioned to be let out of the United States of America. Every last one of the 15 petitions went onto the site in the aftermath of the 2012 presidential election. The first one came from Louisiana. One Michael E. from Slidell. Wrote the following. Well, shucks, where'd it go? I hate it when that happens. Let's leave the wing nuts to their wing nuttery. The white wingers. Goes to show you how little people understand about this union. I think the Louisiana one says, please let us and Texas go. You remember Peter Morrison from last week? I don't want to be in the same country as Vermont. As big as it is, Texas could not survive for a year on its own. What do you mean you're taking Fort Hood and all them other forts and air bases? What do you mean? I thought the planes belonging to the Texas Air National Guard was Texas's. Now, what do you mean they're loaners? What? NASA's leaving Houston. Houston, we got a problem. Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? More ands everywhere. But what are you going to do? And from the wealthy Moran contingent, you know, as F. Scott Fitzgerald said, the rich are very different from you and me. Yes, they are. Sometimes they're even, well, sometimes they're just vastly more stupid. This is the story of Stuart Rahr. No, really, Rahr. Rahr, R-A-H-R, Stuart Rahr. It's also the story of a very Tony restaurant in New York City called Nobu. Nobu is a hot ticket. Nobu is a very fancy place to go and get very tiny little pieces of food. It's a sushi joint. Stephen Rahr was born in Brooklyn. Stephen Rahr is a billionaire. Stephen Rahr has, or thinks he has, a table at Nobu. Got a table at Nobu, right? Stephen Rahr is 66 years old, and apparently with all his billions, the only thing that makes him happy is thinking there's a table at Nobu. You know, it's stories like this that make it real easy to say, you know, line them up. Just line them up. Of course, I'm just kidding. Maybe a little time in a FEMA re-education camp would do this guy some good. He threw a fit, Stephen Rahr did, when he went into Nobu and found other people sitting at his table. And this is one of those disgusting moments of money. He walked up to the people trying to enjoy their dinner. I'll pay you all $1,000 and cover your check. Just get the hell out of here. I want my table. I don't even know whose accent I'm doing there. Just get out. This is my table, eh? Now, the funny thing is, nobody at Nobu has a permanent table. The only people at Nobu who have a permanent table are Robert De Niro and the chef who is his partner. Give you an idea what you pay. You go in for the omakase tasting menu, it's $150 a person. And they're little bitty pieces of food. One of the waiters said, spends a lot of money and it's kind of like he thinks he owns this place. Rahr calls himself the number one king of all fun. Yeah. So they asked him to leave Nobu, this moron, this billionaire moron. He got his money by selling a pharmaceutical distribution company called Kinray And he sold it for $1.3 billion back in 2010. So he threw his hissy there in the restaurant, and the restaurant responded by banning him from all Nobu restaurants forever, for the rest of his natural life. Which is inspiring. It's a good idea. The king of all fun. This goes back to October the 24th. He then turned around and wrote a scathing letter to the manager, who wasn't even there at the time, and copied. I mean, get the hubris of this jackass. He copied in on his hissy fit email. Leonardo DiCaprio, Alicia Keys, Mark Wahlberg, and a bunch of other so-called stars that he says are his buddies. You know, because I'm the king of all fun. This is New York. We were having a conversation a few minutes ago about what to do to avoid buying right-wing pizza. This is New York. This guy could have gone anywhere. Could have gone to one of David Chang's places, and you can't get in the door at those. No, I want my table. You people get up from my table. I'm rich. I'm worth $1 billion. Didn't I tell you I'm worth $1 billion? Just ask me. I'll tell you. Jesus Christ. But whether you're Stephen Rahr, and I don't even know what this guy's politics are. I don't care. Whether you're Stephen Rahr or Rush Limbaugh, there is a certain place on the wealth continuum where when you get to it, nothing's fun anymore. The excitement's all gone. And there's little left but to wait around and until you wind up a simile or a metaphor in something like Edward Arlington Robinson's Richard Cory. Email coming in from Kim in New York City. Actually, I believe some yokel from North or South Dakota created a petition to get New York to secede. Ain't that nice? Guess we have too many Jews and African Americans in New York City. Jack in Shreveport, who should know, says, Louisiana, it just never fails to make me so proud, heavy snark. And I just knew there would be some grammatical or spelling screw-up, and sure enough. Isaac, however, on the other hand, says, peacefully grant the state of Louisiana to withdraw from the United States of America and create its own new government. Let's all sign this so Louisiana can get the hell out of here. But I don't want to have a passport to go to New Orleans. New Orleans is probably my favorite city in the United States, all due respect to all the other cities. Going to New Orleans is like leaving America without having to. I realize it probably makes me a little bit simple, but there's something really special about New Orleans. Something special about being able to walk through the French Quarter on a Sunday morning with a drink in your hand and nobody hassles you. something mighty special about beignets and coffee with chicory. Or a muffaletta. Or po' boy. Nope, I kind of like the whole country, and I'd like to hang on to it. I do, however, suggest we whip the living snot out of the first secessionist that wanders along. I like that Andrew Jackson approach. Please tell my friends in South Carolina that I'm going to get on my horse. And tell them that once I have gotten on my horse, I'm going to get a rope. And I'm going to bring that rope with me, and I'm going to start riding for South Carolina. And when I get to South Carolina, I'm going to find the first secessionist I can, and I'm going to hang him. Then I'm going to look for the second secessionist. And I'll hang secessionists until secessionism is dead in South Carolina. And you know, it's kind of funny, they shut up for a generation. Because they knew Andrew Jackson wasn't kidding. He was in the process of committing a genocide against a few million people. You think he'd blink at taking out a few the snotty-ass aristocrats? You can always tell a secessionist. You just can't tell them much. Probably should save this for prayer meeting Wednesday, but let's not. Let's have our fun. There's nothing quite like watching or hearing Pat Robertson being shocked by the culture in which he lives. In this case, the shock of being told that GASP women look at porn.
You're a sweet Christian girl. Lady.
Absolutely.
All right. Do you see anything in porn that attracts you at all?
No, Pat. Questions that you ask me, really?
I'm trying to get your attitude.
No, that is not an issue for me. Thank you very
much.
Well,
it's boring, really.
Well, for some people...
Wait, stop. Did you catch that? Pat Robertson declares that porn is boring, really. Can we have a little logic moment? He's offering that as a statement of fact, as a statement of conclusory fact. It must mean that he has some sort of a priori knowledge, empirically gathered data. Now, Pat's up in his 80s. So I don't want anybody out there with the mental image of Pat watching, I don't know what, with his withered old member jumping like a snake in a microwave. Oh, no. But we do now, we know something now on this Monday, the 12th of November, 2012, that we didn't know before and that maybe we didn't want to know before, but we know it, by God. We know that Pat Robertson, at some point in time, has viewed porn. Maybe it would be, I don't know, intellectually interesting, certainly not stimulating, but interesting to find out what kind, but I don't know. No.
Two for me. Thank you very much.
Well, it's boring, really.
Well, for some people...
The thing that shocks me, we always thought this was a male thing. A boy thing, a guy thing.
Yeah.
But now, it looks like 30% of women are involved in pornography.
Yeah.
And as author, kind of a little housewifey type, it doesn't look like some...
Wait. Some kind of a little housewifey type? It's a discussion about the success of 50 Shades of Grey. If you really want to enjoy 50 Shades of Grey, go find the YouTube video of Gilbert Gottfried reading from it. course, I don't know, maybe Pat is shocked that women enjoy sex. Maybe in his sort of Old Testament worldview, they're not supposed to. She's a little housewifey type. Well, tell us about the little housewifey type there, Pat, Marion.
Well, housewifey type, it doesn't look like some glamour queen or something out of,
But you know what, Pat? This summer, the big book was Fifty Shades of Grey?
That's one I'm getting ready to introduce.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me let you talk. Fifty Shades of Grey. Everybody was reading the trilogy.
This woman is kind of like a housewife in some little town in England or wherever it is. 50 Shades of Grey is the fastest-selling paper book of all time. And the book's erotic content is limited. Some would call it mommy porn. And while most people think of pornography as something men struggle with, a third of the millions of Americans...
That word, struggle, porn is something men struggle with. I don't know if struggle is the right verb. You can probably come up with several verbs on your own.
Americans who watch porn are
women.
Yes.
Who thought? I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, I never would have thought, yeah.
They're getting addicted to it.
Yeah.
May the universe or God or the flying spaghetti monster or whomever heap all praises on Right Wing Watch for keeping up with Brother Pat. Out there working on the struggle against the struggle with porn. Notice he didn't say struggle against it. He said struggle with it. Well, yeah, Pat, some of it involves struggle, I guess. Some of it involves feathers. We won't go into the other details. But Moran Monday, Pat Robertson never fails to satisfy. Isaac noting with Pat, it's called divine fuckery. It's not pornography. Thank you, Isaac. With regard to Stephen Rahr in New York, Jude notes, sounds like Jack Nicholson's character in As Good As It Gets. And he was a compounded character locked into a self-negating, self-centered, and self-isolating behavior, disliked by everyone. But that was only a movie. Yeah, I remember it. I remember it. Nasty character. Bad movie, too. I mean, I never didn't get much out of that. But you know what? Characters are often drawn from life. Maybe somebody knew Stephen Rahr. Eat the rich. Jack in Shreveport says, yeah, I definitely agree with you on your thoughts about New Orleans. Both with the being able to carry drinks around without being hassled and with the coffee and beignets. And I don't care how unhealthy some of the food might be, I still love Louisiana food. Amen. I get all weepy over a good gumbo. Don't get me started on an etouffee. So we'll close out the Moran Monday nominations, at least on this end. Your end is still you're still wide open. With a little story from here in West Virginia. Sometimes headlines can be misleading. Things like pastor, doctor charged in separate crimes. You read that and you think, okay, well, this must be the police blotter story and the little local battle cry of freedom and moral volcano, right. Then you open it and you read it. No, it's not. It's really, really not. The medical license of a pastor and doctor arrested in two separate incidents has been suspended. State Board of Medical of Medicine suspended Dr. Kenneth Seen's license. State police arrested Seen last week for... Everybody sitting down? Are the dinner dishes cleared? Nah, I mean... Scott, Linda, let me know. The state police arrested Seen last week for allegedly sticking his tongue in the mouth of an elderly male dementia patient with Parkinson's disease while caring for him at the hospital. Seen was also arrested for allegedly beating up a 14-year-old boy at his church. He's charged with battery and child abuse, creating risk of injury. Incident number one happened this past September, when state police say 51-year-old Dr. Seen stuck his tongue in the mouth of a 77-year-old Parkinson's and dementia patient recovering from hip surgery. When he did that, the Parkinson's and dementia patient bit off a part of the doc's tongue. At which point he scurried from the hospital to go and deal with his injury. Later on, well, he had himself this little church on Main Street. You know, one of those storefront churches. A Christian center or some such it was. We could have saved these for Wednesdays, but this is... Now, this is more in Monday material. And he apparently told some kid in the audience, the congregation, what have you, to shut up. The kid back-talked him, and the now pastor attacked him, dragged him into a back room, and continued to work him over. Man of God, man of medicine. A healer. Stuck his tongue in the mouth of a helpless patient whose daughter says that the 77-year-old, after the event, lost his will to live and died just two Fridays back. Take a moment. Let that scene come to full life in your mind. You run a church, you preach at people over the saving grace of Christ Jesus, who died on the cross and rose the third day and forgives all sins. You know, even the sin of sticking your tongue in the mouth of a 77-year-old dementia and Parkinson's patient, who then bites your tongue off. By the way, his two sons are doing time for kiddie porn. The apple falleth not far from the tree. It's a tiny, tiny community. He's delivered people's babies. He's treated colds and treated elderly patients in the hospital's long-term care ward. All the things that a small-town country doctor does, you know, except for that part about sticking the tongue in the dementia and Parkinson's patient and getting his tongue bit off. He was my doctor once. You know, when you grow up as a guy, There are little milestones. Puberty. Getting to vote. And getting old enough to start worrying about your prostate. And when you get that first prostate exam, you really want it to be special. Actually, when you get that first prostate exam, you just want to get through it and not feel too particularly creeped out. And you hope that the doctor has trimmed his fingernails, or hers. This guy was my first prostate exam. Moran Monday on the horn. Your calls at 304-658-3333. And on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. I am Bob Kincaid. This is the horn.
Means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304 854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap. There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Bubble Genius. We got your soap right here.
And got their bath and body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com. 18 minutes before the hour. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, going straight back to the phones just momentarily. But just so you won't think that we're all alone with... God, that's a disc... Ugh. And you know what? The victim is dead and was a dementia patient in the first place and never could have testified. All they've been able to charge the doc with is battery. Can you imagine? Can you just... No, don't imagine. But that whole biting thing among members of the clergy is apparently not limited to the United States. This story comes to us from Adelaide Now. An 80-year-old retired priest allegedly bit an ear off another elderly clergyman during a violent brawl over a parking bay in their block of units. The punch-up broke out on Friday afternoon in a Dianella complex, which houses three retired Catholic priests. Father Thomas Henry Byrne appeared in court charged with grievous bodily harm over the incident involving his neighbor, 81-year-old Father Thomas Joseph Cameron Smith. According to police, after the brawl, Father Byrne told Father Smith to pick up an item on the ground. It was not until Father Smith returned to his unit that he realized the item he had picked up and put in his pocket was his right ear. Father Smith rat. I didn't really? I didn't know ears chewed off so easily. Father Smith wrapped his ear in a tea towel and drove to Dianella Medical Center, where staff phoned for an ambulance and alerted police. He remained in Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital after surgery to save his ear. That story datelined November 10th. I'm guessing they missed some part of the catechism somewhere along the way. Let's go to the phones. Tracy is with us on Skype. Hey, Tracy. Tracy. Oh, there's Tracy again. Hey, Tracy. Tracy. And, okay, I guess that just didn't work out for us. All right, then, to the regular phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, you, Bob?
That's me, Bill. What's up, man?
Oh, man, you got me going ahead tonight, I'll tell you. Where did you get the information on the Civil War stuff, the atrocities? Who sent you? Where did you find that?
What do you mean?
Somebody was talking about how the Union soldiers were slaughtering the Confederate soldiers or something.
Well, no, on the battlefield. They slaughtered each other.
Honest to God, they were too damn good at it, too, I'll tell you. Scarily good at it.
Well, they were using Napoleonic tactics with modern rifled barrels, and they really didn't realize the cumulative effect of those things, Bill.
Well, I'll tell you what, have you seen some of those Petersburg trenches? You throw a machine gun and you got the Western Front in France, what you had, you know?
Yeah.
They were just really going at each other. That's why I was just wondering, because I'm working on a book on a Petersburg mine. And, of course, I'm reading about this mining, and, of course, I'm thinking about talking with you, you know. This acid material embedded in black powder into this mine with lit candles on the wall.
What could possibly go wrong?
Oh, my God. Thank God. I mean, geez. Somebody doing that. Well, we had a few stories. There was a guy sitting at his kitchen table clearing the transmission with a cigar in his mouth. That didn't work out too well either. I remember that. Some of those milestones you really, in the course of your life, you never forget them because they're so unique. Yeah, and Papa John's, what garbage. I mean, I've had this stuff, and it's, you know, give me a break. 14 whole cents, huh?
Yeah, 14 cents.
Oh, my God. And somebody else can't have it.
And it'll be the death. And understand, Bill, that 14 cents will be the death of capitalism as we know it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, you know, we're living. I try to tell some people who are younger than me that, you know, things were not fantastically great ever in my lifetime, but there was a time when a man could get a job, and if you went in and did your job, you could get enough a living wage. And you know what college cost in the 60s compared to now?
What?
Oh, a ton, man.
Oh, yeah,
now
yeah.
Now it's a fortune.
Yeah.
For-profit colleges, this whole for-profit everything is, because a lot of my friends went to Case Western, and these kids were sons of working guys, you know, going to the school, and they weren't academic either. They were going because their father worked in a factory somewhere and made a living wage.
Right, and was able to send them.
Yep. And people, a lot of these youngsters today, they just don't understand the difference between growing up in the. Well, my life was funny because it straddles I in the 50s, between 56 and I hit the T years in 56. So a lot of things happened, you know, the rise of rock and roll, and you know, I'm standing there watching all that. I think I wrote that to you when we first contacted. I said, I feel like I've been standing around watching all these things happen. I remember listening to and learning about Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin and what a schmuck he was. And MacArthur, I actually heard his speech, the old soldier speech.
Right.
My mother said, "You want to stay home this afternoon and watch this?" Because I was kind of a history buff even when I was a young kid. It was just one of those things, and you watch all this stuff happen, and you begin to wonder after. I begin to wonder if I'm a whack job, you know. Did all this stuff really happen? How did we end up where we are? It's like,
why are we in this handbasket, and where are we going?
Yeah, well, exactly. Now I can forgive coal when they first started using it. I don't think half these idiots knew what the hell they were doing. But now, with blowing up mountaintops and what it's doing, I think I don't know.
Well, guess what we got over the weekend, Bill?
Yeah.
Earthquake.
Uh-huh.
Now, there aren't any, you know, it's not like the New Madrid fault. You know, that's over by the Mississippi River.
Yep.
You know, San Andreas is way the hell out in California.
California, yeah.
We don't have just a whole bunch of fault lines running around under the Appalachians that I'm aware of, and I slept through several geology classes in school.
Well, how deep are they blowing up? How deep are they going with that?
Well, it's not so much how deep, it's that you just, well, in fact, I was just watching an email thread coming along, and a woman who has been on this program in the past noted, she said, I looked on Google Earth at the center of the earthquake as delineated by the U.S. Geological Survey, and she said, even with poor resolution, there was no mistaking huge mountaintop removal sites in proximity to the epicenter and massive, massive toxic waste impoundments.
Yep.
And then she said, at the epicenter, there's something that obviously required removal of trees and an access road. She said, I think this might be an injection well or a fracking site.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. Yeah, they're doing a lot of that in two counties away from me, Ashtabula County. They're doing a lot of that.
Well, and I mean, it's been proven already that this conduct causes earthquakes. I'm told by my my friends in California that they don't even get out of bed over a 4.3.
No.
But a 4.3 here, and this was centered in eastern Kentucky or northeastern Tennessee. I can't recall which. It was felt in Knoxville, and it was felt in Charleston.
Oh my!
It was felt down in the Coal River Valley.
That's a good distance, you know.
Yeah, it really is. So it's not a little bit of nothing. Meanwhile, West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. One of the stalwart diehard workers at Coal River Mountain Watch immediately checked in with him and said, you know, what are you guys doing about this? Are you going out? Are you checking the sludge dams? What? You know, because some of these things are leaking at the toe anyway. They're only made out of dirt and rock.
They were cheapest way they could do it. Yeah.
Right. And so consequently, the note came back. Well, yes, we've got people on site, but here's the problem. The people on site doing the inspections are not qualified to determine whether or not the dams are safe.
Yeah.
They don't have the expertise. One of them actually put forward the argument based on something they had found on the interweb tubes that blasting near an earthen dam is good for the dam because it compacts the soil.
Oh, wonderful, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Because you know when it happens with a volcano, they talk about pyroclastic flows. That's basically when earth and magma and it just rushes, you know, in the whatever distance it cares to go.
Yeah.
But something similar happens if one of these dams gives away. It liquefies.
Yeah.
The whole dam liquefies, and it just... And a 100-foot wall of water, for instance, out of the Brushy Fork impoundment down in Raleigh County, it's been posited by the engineers when they first built the cursed thing that when it breaks, it'll send a 100-foot-high wall of toxic waste roaring down the Coal River Valley, and it'll kill everything in sight. 1,000 people will die immediately.
The bottom line is most of the people in our country don't seem to pay any attention to anything anymore. Well, they never did. You're familiar with what happened, why Johnstown was hit with that huge flood?
Sure.
Because a sportsman had a lake up in the mountains. Henry Clay Frick and that bunch, you know. When I was a kid, maybe in 1950, we were about six blocks north of this big steel mills and all kind of. So Ohio had a place down there, you know, Standard Oil of Ohio, and we got wind out of the south, man. And holy God, the stink! The only thing I can say now, at least it smelled like money in those days. The guys that were working there were making a wage, you know, that paid them.
Yeah, and they were breathing that toxic waste, and ultimately they paid a price for it, but they were getting a paycheck at the time.
Yeah, that was, what the hell was there to do, to make a living? You know what?
Well, right, and that's at the heart and soul of capitalism. Capitalism, to the extent that it possibly can, wants to make sure that a potential workforce has no choice. Okay, for instance, Appalachia is a mono economy. There's, eventually a chemical industry developed along the Kanawha River in the Kanawha Valley, but primarily coal is a mono economy. It cannot succeed if people have any other recourse than working in the mines. Or at least it couldn't when it was labor intensive. Now, very few people work in coal at all. But they've still made enough of a mess. Who wants to come to somewhere where the water's poison? What, I mean, assuming there's a corporation out there that actually gives a tinker's damn about its employees, who would want to locate their factory, their distribution center, their whatever, in a place where the schools are a mess, the water is toxic, and the air is laden with mining filth?
Yeah, you name it. Well, but I guess there was problem even with the TVA project. There's leftover crap down in, you know, around, you know, when they put the electricity through. When nobody else would touch it, the government had to do it, you know. But they, I guess they got waste deposits down there, too.
And remember, when the first dam was, I mean, it was built by the federal government. It was on the Tennessee River. It was meant for flood control. This is pre-TVA.
Yeah.
It was built around, oh, gosh, the around 1917 or so. It was later named Wilson Dam for Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
And guess what happened?
Probably broke.
Henry Ford jumped on the federal government and said, well, I see you built yourself a dam down there. I'd like to buy it from you.
Oh.
They said, well, okay, maybe. And so Henry Ford set about building an entire city. If you look at a map of, for anybody familiar with Detroit, if you look at a map of Muscle Shoals, Alabama, you'll notice that all of its main drags have the same names as the main drags in Detroit.
I'll be darned.
He built sidewalks for subdivisions that weren't even there. And what he was going to do, he was going to use Wilson Dam's hydroelectric power and he was going to relocate all of his automotive industry into the South, which was, of course, union unfriendly.
Not union, right, yeah.
And he was going to use the power off of Wilson Dam to power his auto manufactory. And the people who lived around there were just going to, you know, suck it up. And eventually the federal government said, no, I don't think so.
Well,
because we would like to provide electricity for people who don't have it, so and improve their standard of living.
Yeah.
And well, so for years and years and years, there were these weird little squared off areas of, I mean, you wouldn't call them a ghost town because they never existed. But sidewalks and city blocks through weeds. It's weird. It's really weird.
Well, Ben, Ford was, I used to work with a woman, and I'm talking in the 60s now, but he used to give me copies of a magazine. It was called The Cross and the Flag. Henry L. K. Smith. You ever hear of him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at this stuff. I was maybe 18, 19.
Well, and what was the paper that Henry Ford put out in the early part of the 20th century? It was the Dearborn something or another, or
yeah.
And it was this
something connected with his.
It was straight up Nazi, anti-Semitic as the day was long, because that's how Henry Ford was.
Well, are you familiar with the name of Harry Bennett?
I recognize it, but I can't place it.
He was the guy that ran the Ford Police Department. I had an uncle who was read a lot about Ford. He passed along this stuff to me, Bennett and Ford went to Philly to sell the River Rouge Railroad, sold it for $7 million, brought the money back in suitcases in cash.
Wow.
Strange person. And the story that he used to go through this one gate every day. I'll leave you with this one because it's kind of a sick, cynical laugh. Ford would come in, and there was an old-timer, open the gate, you know, watchman, always polite and nice to Ford and Bennett. And Henry Smith, that guy's such a good guy. He says, get him a car. So they get the guy a Model A. And after that, every morning, the guy shined on that Model A when Henry came in with Bennett. And finally, after a few months of this, Ford says, that guy pays too much attention to that car. Steal it. Yeah, what kind of a guy that... And Bennett and Ford would sit in their office and shoot guns through the ceiling. Secretaries around on the second floor and accountants and stuff would be dancing around up there. That's how intensely insane this class of people could be. This money class.
Parasites.
Yeah.
Ticks.
Me, you give me, if I get enough money, I won't bother a soul the rest of my life. I'll just find me a place of, in the summer where I can fish, and in the winter where I can fish, and then how with the rest of it, you know?
If you give a man a fish, you fed him for a day, but if you teach a man to fish, you've given him a reason to sit by the river and drink beer all day.
Drunk, yeah. Anyway, take care of yourself.
You have a good night, Bill.
Amen, man.
Bye now. Bye. And to Skype, where I think Tracy is back. You there, Tracy? Tracy? Tracy?
Can you hear me now?
I hear you now.
Oh, come on. Seriously? This sucks.
What
sucks?
Oh,
well. Oh, you do? Okay. I'm just talking out my ass, as usual. Hello, Bob. How the hell are you?
I'm just fine as frogs here, Tracy. How about you?
Oh, just, come on. Is it my... Okay, I'm actually doing really well. Just glad that, you know, keys to the house. So I can go in the house. So I can get a better internet connection. I will be out. So, no, I was just... I had an... I don't know, a very strange experience. I was in Cambria over the weekend. And I went to one of those little antiques, you know, stores and everything. And it was really cool.
Okay, for those of us who are geographically challenged, Cambria...
Cambria in the central coast of California. One of the reasons why I live, stay in California, because it's so beautiful. So first we went to Cambria, and it was really pretty and majestic. And then we went into one of these little antique stores where I saw a little picture, something, you know, along the mammy kind of things, you know, like with Step and Fetch It, with the little black kids with the big red lips and the white lips.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something about nigga this, nigga that. So, me being me, you'd have been proud. I just walked out the store and didn't say anything.
Now, was this an antique?
Yeah, it was an antique.
Well, you know, I remember a story several years back, and it predates your arrival here in the Horn family, Tracy. There's actually a market out there in bogus, antiques along with, because there were a bunch of products out there that were named like that. And now there are people who hustle, I guess you'd call them reenactment what would be the word?
I don't know.
But they're counterfeits of old brands, old racist brands. And, I mean, they can't keep them in stock.
No. And... Of course, Jan walks in and says, well, you're going to say anything? I'm like, no, because I'm not even going to just. It's one of those things. Remember how I said that my mom called me a racist, and I said, no, I'm a bigot. But then my brother said, no, you just point stuff out. And typically I do, but I kind of left it alone. And I just walked out the store, and I'm wondering, should I say it? Should I?
No, especially in the present climate, and it's
right.
Unlike me to say no, don't say anything, but there are people out there. I mean, look, if they were in good faith, it wouldn't have been offered for sale.
Right.
Okay.
And that's
you put that stuff out for sale, as a form of incitement. And so the minute it goes on the shelf, they've already got their argument lined up. You know, well, I mean, we got a lot, and this is the way it goes. We got a lot of black people like that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of black people come in and buy that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's heritage. Because what we're doing is we're recognizing heritage.
Oh. Yeah. See, because it's like listening. I mean, the weekend started off really nice because it was so funny. The purpose of this week, past weekend, is my mom's birthday weekend, and both of us have always wanted to go to Hearst Castle. So then, yeah, me, you know, of course, when I was younger, Hearst Castle was, thinking about going to Hearst Castle was awesome until I found out who William Randolph Hearst.
Right, and what went into building it.
And what he was about. And I'm like, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, what's the name of that place?
Which one?
It's got the Hearst Castle. It's got a specific name.
Something Enchanted Hill or something like that.
Well, no, I know that it was renamed, you know, because in Citizen Kane is a thinly veiled biography of Hearst,
and
very thinly veiled.
Right, and it becomes Xanadu there.
Right. Let's see. Look,
somebody will tell me in a minute. No worries.
I'll tell you in a minute. But so, you know, because see, I try very desperately not to react to things because I am a reactionary, and I'm not going to lie about that. But what bothers me, and my mom and I almost got into an argument yesterday because we went to Chumash, which is an Indian casino out here in Santa Barbara County, Santa Ynez. And so there was a bunch of us on the elevator, me, my mom, and Jan, and then a whole bunch of Hispanic people. And so it was these three white people, and they said, oh, we'll just take another elevator. And me being me said, what, you're afraid this, what, there's too many dark people on the elevator?
No let up.
You drink it all?
No.
Oh, in the bag. So I was like, I'm just like, okay, maybe. And my mom's like, well, why do you get so upset? It's like, it's not.
Oh, San Simeon. No, but that.
Oh, yeah. That's the city.
Well, no, there was one in the north of California and another one in Southern California. Is that right?
I don't know. I just know her. It was named something first. I forget, but because they did the whole thing about. But anyhow, and I got upset with her because I said, that's the. Yeah, she's like. Because she said something to, well, why does it upset you? I said, because it doesn't upset you. I said, because that's the problem with race in this country, and because nobody talks about it. And when somebody like me says something about it, oh, you're just being reactionary.
Well, that's the thing. We only tend to talk about it, Tracy, when there has been something, and I mean, I'm as guilty as the next person, when there has been something inflammatory done, like, for instance, at the beginning of the program this evening, this young girl who didn't from the Duke lacrosse team, who in the process of the whole team dressing up as the Little Rascals, well, I guess she drew the one that said buckwheat. So she came to the Halloween party at the lacrosse team's coach's house in blackface.
Oh. And she thought it was. And see, that's the problem. She thought it was okay.
Right, because I'm sure that going to Duke and everything, she probably speaks to two or three black people a week, and so that means she doesn't hate black folks, and yeah, right.
No. And see, and
I mean that goofy woman from California, who posted the tweet about hoping that somebody assassinates President Obama, but instead of assassinates, there were some expletives involved and the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
And when pressed by Fox 34 or whatever television station, no, I don't consider myself a racist. That's just my opinion.
Right.
As if being opinion eliminates any racism, sure.
And see right there, because there is the problem. Since we don't talk about race, and since people, like you said, the young lady coming to the school, you know, to the party in blackface, and like I was listening to, I had the trifecta, almost the trifecta. I was on two radio talk shows on Friday in L.A. Shocking. But one of them we talked, there was a thing about race. Mo Kelly was talking about how, I guess there's a website called Jezebel.com or .net or something. And I guess it sucks all the racially tainted tweets out there. And it started off, the conversation started off as, why is it that these young people think it's okay? What is it about what is it about me being a black person or black people in general that certain people, okay, white people, think it's okay to, like you're saying, F the president, kill the president? And that, oh, it's just my opinion. I don't really mean these things. The blatant racism and the ugliness of these people, and the sad part is they don't.
Well, consider the riot over at the University of Mississippi last week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was not a riot over the budget. That was not a riot over Obamacare.
No.
That was a riot over Obama president.
President. Period.
Obama reelected. I mean,
you know,
I don't often try to go I don't try to imagine myself into the skulls of right wingers very often.
Please don't.
I know, but I remember. I remember how horrified we were when Bush's second term was stolen for him, stolen in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's really no question anymore. It was stolen. And we watched as, I forget that British tabloid that said, how can 53 million people be this stupid? Talking about the people who voted for a second term. And I guess that's how right-wingers fit. Yeah, well, I mean, it was bad enough we got him, that one, the first time, you know, them blah people the first time through. But, I mean, well, dang, I mean, couldn't we figure it out by now?
Well, it's like yesterday when we woke up in San Simeon and I turned on the television. Because my girl's a bit of a news junkie. But the only thing she could find was Fox News. And there they were.
Ick.
The Republicans.
Sure.
Talking about, I guess there's this one gentleman, he was the Hispanic liaison for Mitt Romney Gutierrez, who's, I guess, a Cuban-born American or Cuban-American. And typically Cubans vote Republican. I don't know why, but... You know, that,
well,
you
gotta, that used to be something you could really count on, but now the Cubano community is about 50-50.
Right. And so...
But the rest of the Latino community is ain't gonna.
And so they were asking, well, why do you think this happened? And old boy straight up said, because the GOP is scaring the hell out of the Hispanics.
Well, what would you... I mean... I mean, you've got Willard Romney there talking about self deportation, you know.
And that's one of the things. And so, of course, so he was the whole panel. Actually, I take that back. It wasn't Fox News; it was CNN, State of the Nation. So they had four or five panelists, all of Republican, and he's the only one out of the him and Huntsman, and then there was these other two idiots. Both of them were saying, you know, we as the GOP, we really need to rethink the way rebrand us, or, you know, our message or what have you, right? And like Gutierrez was talking about, you know, the language barrier and how, you know, you got to speak English, Spanish. And now, the man is telling you as a Hispanic what the problem is. Even though he's a Republican, first and foremost, he's Hispanic. Before he was a Republican, he was born Hispanic. So you think he would know what his people think, or the people that he, quote unquote, are representing.
But that in itself is always dangerous, calling on one individual to speak for some monolithic.
But you, of course, because it's like, you know, when white people ask me a question about black people, I say, okay, speaking for the entire black race, because, you know.
Right, exactly. And you know, every time I open up the mic, I'm speaking for Northern European, Scots-Irish people with the profound ability to almost magically produce cholesterol.
Exactly. And so, his point was, you know, from the people that he spoke to in his community, he's like, this is not going to work. If you, you know, and he says something about English. And then this idiot, I forget what it is, something family values, whatever, one of those idiots, and saying, well, you know, well, English is the language of the United States. Right there. The man is telling you what one of your problems is.
Yeah, see, but I can't. The minute I hear one of those, I have to turn the channel, turn the TV mm-hmm. off, leave the room, go out in the yard, run around in circles, tearing at my hair and clothing.
And
I was explaining, oddly enough, it's interesting you would bring this up, because I was explaining it to Ferg earlier today. I said, anytime you hear a right-winger talking about making English the official language, I said, you can blow right past things like, okay, that'll be fine as soon as we learn how to speak it. You know, that's the, you know.
Right.
I mean, it was George Bernard Shaw who said, the English barely understand their own language and the Americans not at all, or something like, or barely speak their own language and the Americans not at all, something like that.
Yeah, that's
You can blow right past that, though. And it's so much fun to look at one of these right-wingers and say, okay, quick, name the first European language spoken on the North American continent.
Would that be, I don't know.
Yeah, I'll take Spanish for a million, Alex. And actually, English was kind of a Johnny-come-lately. You had Portuguese spoken in the Americas. You had Spanish spoken in the Americas. You had French. You had Dutch spoken in the Americas before English was getting spoken here.
Because the English was not here yet, Bob.
They hadn't come over. See, here's the thing about that little thing called history and opening a book
and reading it.
Yeah, but books are full of... Well, you have to remember that their patron saint, Tracy, is Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan famously said, facts... Now, the real quote is, and it's a great quote, facts are stubborn things. Which means, of course, that facts are facts and you really can't get around them. But Ronald Reagan transformed it in one of his Reaganisms. I just found out over the weekend, for instance, that when he first became president,
mm-hmm.
he asked for his chief of staff to show him the war room.
Yeah.
And his chief of staff said, "Well, Mr. President, there isn't one." And Reagan said, "Well, I know there is because, I saw it in that movie, Dr. Strangelove. Dr. Stead, I saw the war room. It has to exist. But it doesn't. It was just made up. But that was the world he inhabited. You know, this is the president who gave us ketchup as a vegetable. And so I forget exactly what circumstances there were, what the circumstances were. But at one point in time, he announced to God and everybody in front of microphones that, well, facts are stupid things. And that should be translated into Latin and made a part of the coat of arms or crest or official seal of the Republican Party. Facts
yes.
are stupid things. Because that's the entire operating philosophy of the GOP. The factory... I remember David Susskind's article back during the Bush administration, Tracy, when the Bush administration told him... Well, you all just run around with your facts and your reality. And while you're doing that, we'll be shaping reality. Reality-based people. And it was meant as an insult. You reality-based people.
Well, what is that? Did you see the clip that I sent you from John Stewart?
Oh, yeah.
And what is that scientific gobbledygook?
Yeah.
Gobbledygook or goop or whatever. It just saddened me because, see, and back to what I was watching on Sunday, so they had the three white, the Hispanic guy, the two white guys, and then the female, who I guess is, they were showing the Republican leadership of Congress. So the guy's like, so here's all these white men. This is the commentator. So and there you are in the back. And you're saying that there's nothing wrong with this picture for the Republican Party? You know, of course, they try to, well, we do have a Hispanic, Mark Rubio. And there's our woman.
Right. Susana Martinez and Mark Rubio and Ted Cruz have all been nominated in advance as front runners for the Republican nomination in 2016 simply because they are Hispanic. And there is, you see, Tracy, there's a degree of political cynicism in that. That says that it doesn't matter what policies they profess, as long as they've got a Hispanic last name, well, we'll just, you know, we'll get, by God, we'll get the Latino vote like that. I mean, look, all those blah people voted for Obama just because he was black. I mean, my God, I mean, who was the right wing Repiglican who basically declared that? Was it Sununu who said, Colin Powell only endorsed Obama because he's blah, too.
Yeah. Well, see, so they were, you know, the main topic was what happened with the Republican Party, why did they lose? And so when he asked the woman about, well, you know, there's all these white men, you know, of course, you know, Mitch McCulloch, you know, I'm a Turner McCullough, John Boehner, oh, I'm sorry, Boehner. And all these, and then there was her, and she's like, well, obviously something's not wrong because we still have control of the house, and I want them to scream at the TV. And Jan's like, stop. You have control of the house because of gerrymandering. If you didn't have the gerrymandering and doing a lot of redistricting. That's to hold on to these.
But wait, Tracy, that's not, and I'm not just gainsaying you, that's not entirely factual, because those sleazy bastards gerrymandered the hell out of Texas, but because of the 2010 census, Texas got new congressional seats. Guess what?
Democrat.
All of them but one went Democrat.
Well, no, she was saying that the ones that they did win their elections is because of gerrymandering, not because so much of the fact that these people.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you drill down into the county, into the county by county state maps, you'll see, for instance, that there is a congressional district in Alabama that will probably always be held by a Democrat.
Yep.
Because it has, because it encompasses a huge swath of the community of color in a significant population center, ergo.
But see, that's what's so funny about a lot of times, like this whole thing. What tickles me about the Republicans, sometimes they're too smart for their own good. They think that we're stupid because, you know, we're those dirty, stupid liberals and, you know, we don't know how the real world works. So, and then if again, I think we've already talked about this, if your ideals were so fabulous and so wonderful, why do you have to cheat? Why do you have to gerrymander? Why do you have to lie your way through an election? If your ideals are what the... Your ideals is what the country is looking for. I'm just saying. So obviously, thank God, you know, because, you know, the Republicans outspent us to, what, 2-1 margin on the money? But because of things like social media, Twitter, Facebook, and all that, thank God.
Yeah, if I was Karl Rove, I would not go anywhere that any high-rolling Republican donor was in possession of a baseball bat or a croquet mallet or a golf club. Or
anything that would have been a weapon on Murder, She Wrote or Columbo.
Right. Or the Untouchables.
Because, see, the bottom line is, what I love about the Republicans is the fact that they are so entrenched in their dogma, in their ideology, that they cannot think that outside the box that people are actually thinking for themselves. And that the age of the angry white man is going bye-bye. Because, first of all, they're dying out. You know, we have maybe one more generation to live through before they're all gone. What do you think? Maybe one or two?
No. It's kind of the way the Republicans look at gerrymandering congressional districts of color. They know that they can't get rid of, you know, short of getting rid of the franchise, they can't get rid of Democrats entirely. And we must understand that there will always be a few of those sick, white-wing, repig-licking, hood-wearing, night-riding monstrosities that we're never going to completely get rid of them. But they can be they can be marginalized. And ultimately, what I think we saw, but there are still holes in this thesis that I haven't figured out how to plug. What we saw was self-marginalization. But by the same token, you still wind up with what we saw here, for instance, where in the state of West Virginia, you know, everybody was going to vote against Obama because he got that there war on coal. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So Romney carried this state like 68-32%. It was awful. But lo and behold, our junior senator stomped the guts out of his Republican challenger, and
yeah,
our sort of incumbent governor gave a proper whooping to his Republican challenger. My Democratic congressman put a whooping on his Republican challenger. But then once you got past that, ballot, it turns into a real bloodbath.
Yeah,
I mean, the state house, the House of Delegates of West Virginia, is just barely still Democratic and has not been Republican majority controlled since 1928. Okay?
Wow.
That's the shift that you're looking at. I keep talking about Wisconsin because I've become a big fan of Wisconsin. Lo and behold, Barack Obama carries Wisconsin. Tammy Baldwin wins a Senate seat, but bang, the Wisconsin House and the Wisconsin Senate turn Republican, which is going to have terrible long-term consequences over the next couple of years for the people there. And, you know, how did that happen? And there are hard questions that have to be asked and answered, Tracy, about the way the Obama team ran this campaign. They ran it for him, by him, of him, and there were no coattails whatsoever to be found.
No. And see, and that's one of my things that I constantly think about when I listen to you and Randy and stuff. What is us, as liberals, progressives, and dare I say, Democrats, what is it that we're doing wrong? That we, well, it's not us, but, you know, the party or what have you. What are we doing wrong, and what can we do to fix this, to get our message across? Is it because we don't, you know, like I think we don't know how to speak to Southerners or...
Well, sure, that's a start. That's absolutely a start. Howard Dean's 50-state strategy was abandoned in favor of Rahm Emanuel's pick-the-low-hanging-fruit strategy. And I understand that when all you're doing is electoral college math. But if you ever want to actually change the tenor and quality of governance in this country and move boldly and bravely and with a smile on our faces into the future, sooner or later, we're going to have to start, if the Democratic Party doesn't want to marginalize itself, it's going to have to start getting serious about getting Democrats in office in the South and you know, just word to the wise, to the smart guys, the smart women, blue dogs ain't going to cut it.
There's not going to...
Because we had, you know, that was part, you know, remember, if you look at the electoral losses of 2010, Tracy, what you find out is the blue dogs got their asses handed to them because Republicans and teabaggers said, well, I'd just rather have the real thing. Exactly. On the other hand, with the exception of Alan Grayson, progressives did okay in 2010. And then lo and behold, Alan Grayson's back.
Back. And that's what I was listening. I mean, God bless Gabby Giffords for what she went through, and she was another one. Because I was during the Democratic National Convention.
Well, bless her heart, Gabby was kind of a blue dog.
No, kind of. She was not kind of.
Okay. Right.
And because even to the point where when that night at the Democratic National Convention when she led the Pledge of Allegiance, and they were interviewing her husband. And they were setting up some kind of, you know, because of course she was not going to run again. They were setting up some kind of foundation and for moderate this. And I'm like, really, in Arizona, moderate? You're going to try to get another blue dog Democrat and it's from a state where they have the craziest?
No, you've got to offer people a meaningful and viable choice. And that's,
right.
You know, and that's why I keep saying, you know, sure would be nice if President Obama would pick up the phone and say, Howie, are you doing anything these days, Howard?
Exactly, because, you know, Howard Dean, with his little short self, is like, sometimes I felt like he was the man of La Mancha.
Tilting at windmills? Sure.
Because he had the vision. You cannot, you know, and it's, because like I live in California. Fortunately, we have, you know, this, with our elections, this last election cycle, we have our state assembly, two-thirds, the Democrat, you know, we have a supermajority.
Right.
In the Congress, in our state. But, again, like you were talking about during the election, nobody thinks about California as far as the presidential election. Because they know President Obama knew he had the state. That's why he didn't come. He came out here to tie up traffic and make money and, you know, get that money, but he did not campaign out here, nor did Romney. And to me, that's kind of a slap in the face. It's like, what, California don't matter?
But there would, it would have made as much sense to go to California as it would have to come to West Virginia for exactly the opposite reasons.
Right.
You know, we were in the bag, and so were y'all. Just different bags. Now, for my part, I want to start getting real serious about asking very, very politely and very pleasantly but very earnestly and very seriously for President Obama to come to West Virginia now. And I want him to, you know what? I want him to visit my buddy Bo Webb. I want him to go right up the holler there so that he can see what it's like to live 300 feet below a mountaintop removal operation. Hopefully, they'll be blasting that day.
Exactly.
Because it, you know, if my buddy Bo could look at him and say, yeah, imagine Sasha and Malia and Michelle breathing this crap.
All day long. 24/7.
Yeah.
365, and this year, 366 days a year. So that's, because that's where, to me, that is where the problem is. Like you said, okay, don't come out to California during the election. You're right, because you have California. And why waste your money and your efforts going to West Virginia? Because you know Romney's going to carry it. But as the president of these United States, and once you, since you are reelected, like you said, like Howard Dean, the 50-state plan, because 2014 will be here before we know it. We're all, you know, in the afterglow of, oh, we won, we won. I was calling my friends and singing, we won, we won. We shot the BB gun. They lost, they lost. They ate the applesauce. But then again, after I said all that, I started thinking 2014. Because, you know, the Republicans already think it's 2014, and they're definitely thinking 2016. So we, as Democrats, as progressive, like you said, every progressive that ran against a crazy Republican, didn't all the progressives win?
A lot of them did.
Elizabeth Warren, Grayson, Sherrod Brown, who else won?
Tammy Baldwin, fairly progressive.
Mm-hmm. So there's something... It, you know, we're not the powers that be, but we got some sense, Bob. You and I. And I know
well, what I want to know is what is happening on the in the state party levels that allowed I want to know, was it candidates running away from Obama? Because Tammy Baldwin didn't run away from Obama, to the best of my knowledge. Elizabeth Warren did not run away from Obama. Alan Grayson did not run away from Obama. Sherrod Brown did not run away from Obama.
Did not. So, you know, maybe you and I need to one day sit down, and I'm not even playing with this. One day we get on Skype or sit down, and we should pen a letter to the powers that be, to our
Well, I kind of think that every broadcast we do here is a letter to the powers that be, Tracy.
Yeah, do they hear it? Do they listen?
Sometimes we get a little hint.
Okay. Well,
hi, Van.
Okay. Hi, Malia. Hi, Sasha.
No, I don't think they get to listen.
No, they probably... Oh, no, not, especially not with my mouth once I go on a rant. I'm being good today, actually. But I want you guys to listen. Those that, if you, you know, aside from me running for office, because I couldn't, because I wouldn't want to go through that background check. there's too many things, too many skeletons. But I would make an interesting candidate. But I just want you guys to listen to the fact that the people who did not run, two things that these people, Sherrod, Dallin, Elizabeth Warren, all these people, Mr. President, they did not run from you as candidates, and they won, and they were progressive, or are progressive. I'm speaking in the past tense like they're dead. They are progressive. So obviously, something that these people spoke to their constituents in such a way that they got rid of the craziness in their respective part, you know, in their respective races. So, Mr. President, Mr., like you said, Rahm Emanuel, thank God, somebody said he's out of, you know, he's no longer in the inner circle, but he, I guess from what I hear, he's running.
Yeah, but I think President Obama still takes his calls.
No, but there has to be a shift in the way we do things. I mean, like, when we were going up the coast over the weekend, and I'm looking at how beautiful my state is, Central Coast, I've lived here all my life, and I've never driven up the Central Coast, Highway 1. And I'm just looking at this state, and I have, when I see how beautiful my state is, I have no problem paying taxes. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because if you get to
drive on decent roads to find out how beautiful your state is, that makes that tax paying easier too.
It makes, and when I shifted, even though I was thinking about William Randolph Hearst and how I was like, oh, God, this yellow journalism and all this and the lies. But then I thought about the fact that the money that is going, that $25 that each that I pay for us to go on that tour, is going to the California State Conservatory. Because Williams, the Hearst Castle is a part of a state park.
Right. I know that much.
So that made me feel so much better. I'm like, okay, it's a state park. Because you see how I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Because, and I'll put, if you look at my Facebook page, I'll post some of the pictures. I'll send them over to you guys, to the Horns Facebook page. Why I live in California.
By the way, Jack just wrote in from Shreveport with a little observation, Tracy, I think would be good for this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what are we liberals doing wrong? He said, I'll bet I'm not even close to really figuring out what the root causes of what liberals are doing wrong are. But one area to look at is that we are projecting just as the conservatives are, i.e., mm-hmm. we think they think like we do. And
right.
I think we could probably shorten that a little bit and say that we have this nasty habit of thinking that they think. And I'm really not saying that as a smartass, Tracy.
You're not.
Because just watching the interweb tubes over the course of this last seemingly endless election season tells me that they're not very good at it. Now, they can copy and paste with the best of them, and
yep.
they can repeat talking points beautifully. I mean, they can parrot a talking point like nobody's business. But in terms of actually skull-sweating it out, not so much.
Not so. And see, like I said, I don't like to talk down to people because, look, I consider myself a political baby. I did not become political. I mean, I voted all my life because, again, it makes something in my brain explode when black people don't vote, especially women. It's like, how dare you not? So I've made it a priority, and I've made it a priority for my son to make sure we voted, that he, as soon as he turned 18. But I only became aware, you know, I've always had that thing about right and wrong, regardless, you know, as I got older and wiser, you know, even though I didn't know much about Reagan when I was 18, because that's 1984, was the first time I voted. But there was just something inherently wrong about the man. There was just something, there was like a wrong radar that went off on me, in my gut. I'm like, there's just something not right about this man. And then Bush, and then I'm like, okay, there was just something. Something swarmy. There was just, ugh. And then, you know, now I said I'm older, and when I love it when my Republican friends talk about how wonderful Reagan was. I'm like, you mean the same man that when he was governor made it so that back before he became governor, the UCs was free for California residents, and now look how much it costs to go to school? You mean the same man that closed down mental hospitals in the state and federal?
But he loved America, Tracy, and he always made sure he kept his suit jacket on in the Oval Office, and that made him a great president worthy of being placed upon Mount Rushmore.
This man was single-handedly responsible for the meteoric rise of mentally ill homeless people in this country in the 70s and the 80s.
Absolutely. By the way, you're getting a suggestion from R.L. Smith NoCal in the chat room. He says, Tracy, you need to get further north to see how much more beauty there is in this state.
Oh, see, I have been. And that's the funny part, because I've been to San Francisco, I've been to Napa, I've been to Sonoma and the East Bay and all that. I lived in San Francisco for a while when I went to school. Why I say went away to college, which really means I ran away to college.
Yep.
But, no, it's so crazy because whenever I've driven up north, I've always gone through up the five, which is a wretchedly horrible, ugly drive. I know, no disrespect for my friends in Fresno and Modesto and all that. I'm sorry, but the 5 is ugly and it stinks. I mean, especially going. I mean, the cows. There's this one stretch that's what you, and it's like methane gas. You have to roll up your windows and put on a gas mask, and you can still smell how bad it smells. So for me to go up, Highway 1 over the weekend, it almost brought me to tears. Of how, just how, you know, because there was in San Simeon and I guess all along the Central Coast, they have, if you want a bag, you can't get plastic bags at all. And if you want it back, there's a 10-cent surcharge. And so my dad was like, well, why? I said, this is a coastal community. They don't, you know, they don't want plastic bags strewn across this majestic coastline. So I have no problems with not having any plastic bags and paying a 10-cent charge for a bag. And trust and believe, I'm no environmentalist. I don't recycle. Sorry to say. I don't.
Now, you're going to get hate mail.
I'm going to get hate mail, but I'm honest. I try, you know, but I don't think about it.
Yeah, but is it available? I mean, is it available to you? Is it one of those things that's out at the curb?
No. It's standard in California, in L.A. If you live in a house, they have, you know, the trash bins for private trash pickup. They do have, you know, paper, lawn clippings and stuff for, you know, and recyclables, place paper, plastic, aluminum. But if you live in an apartment like I do, no, you just have one big trash bin. And trust, and this is something that I've talked to my owner, not the owner, but the managers of the building about, would it be so difficult to have, you know, something like that? Because I live in an apartment, so I don't have, you know, I mean, considering how big my apartment is, I still don't have the space to do, I mean, let me take that back. I do have the space. I just don't. And yes, I'm going to get the hate mail and the leers, like, how dare you? You call yourself, you love your state so much. You love your majestic coastline. But, like I said, it's one of those things I don't think about, which is awful of me. It is. It is. I admit it. I you know, I have my hand out. Horn family, you can spank my hand. You know.
Understood. Understood. You know. Well, Tracy, you have yourself a wonderful evening, dear. I'm going to roll on and kind of wind it up for the evening. But
please do.
Thank you for the travel log. I hope you will post the photos there on the Horn Facebook page. I'm sure folks would love to see them. I know I would. I'm still working on that plan to eventually remedy my never having visited your fair state.
I cannot believe this. I am, dude. I'm sick. As soon as you let me know, because my mom is going back home, so the extra room reopened. Sorry, Tim.
Well, the fact of the matter is, Netroots Nation this summer is in San Jose.
Okay. What's in San Jose this summer? Say that again.
Netroots Nation.
Is it really?
Yes.
And what month in
If you go to netrootsnation.org, you'll have all the details you could possibly want. I don't know what the dates are.
Oh, I am so there.
But
oh.
I would love to figure out a way, and of course, you know, we struggle just to keep the bills paid here, but I'd love to figure out a way to get out there.
Look, if I have to come and pick you up, Bob, I will. I ain't playing. I gotta pick you that deep fried taco. I have to.
I gotta. Oh, you're telling me.
The deep fried shrimp taco. Well, I'm gonna let you go as usual, but you know, as I.
And what is it? I want a dog from Pink's, right?
Yes. Not so much. There's so many other. There's so.
Okay. Okay. Just checking.
So many better places. But like I always say, may God bless you and keep you and keep on pushing, because I sure as hell am.
Well, we'll get you recycling.
Yeah, I know. I'm working on it. I even have an extra trash can in my kitchen. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to start putting the dog.
Once you start, it's like second nature.
Okay.
And then once you start, you feel really good, Tracy, because then you know that you're not contributing to that portion of the Pacific Ocean that's as big as the state of Texas, if not larger, that's nothing but old six pack loops, plastic grocery bags, and plastic bottles.
Okay, you convinced me. Okay, I'm going to work on it. I promise.
It's not hard. It's not hard at all.
I know. I'm just trifling. I'm just lazy. I'm going to need it.
Nah, I didn't say that. Tracy, you have a good night, dear.
You too, my love. Bye.
Bye now. Tracy calling from, yes, California. We'll make a recycler out of her yet. But I don't think that's quite any reason to, too many good things about Tracy. Right wingers who don't recycle, yeah, they're hopeless. A correction. I do like to correct factual errors on this program, especially when I'm the one making them. Over the course of the program, you know, I mentioned the fact that it certainly is kind of weird to be having an earthquake there in southeast Kentucky, northeast Tennessee. And I said, it's not like there's a fault line there. Wrong. I was asleep that day in geology. There is a fault line in the Appalachians, right smack dab where the earthquake occurred. The particular quote from the website to which I was alerted, Pine Mountain, just to the east of Whitesburg, Kentucky, where the earthquake was centered, is actually on a fault line. It's called the Pine Mountain Fault Thrust. Pine Mountain stretches as a fault ridge, meaning a giant crack in the earth from Elk Gap at Pioneer to the breaks of the Sandy in Kentucky, extending to near the Virginia and West Virginia lines. It extends in a regular northeast direction, with only two water gaps throughout its whole 130 miles, one at Pineville and again at the renowned Narrows near Jellicoe. The breaks of the Sandy are sometimes counted, which would be three water gaps. But, yeah, there's a fault line there, so we should probably take that into consideration. In the course of our conversation, oh, by the way, a very happy announcement to make. Thank you very kindly. We have met Dr. John's challenge for this evening, and we have exceeded the evening's fundraising goal, and by a factor of about $40, we did some catching up with what we didn't do last week. So that takes a little bit of pressure off, and if we can do that every night this week, we will get maybe to close to where we need to be by the time the 15th of the month rolls around, which is only 3 days away, at which point we should be at $1,500. Okay, no, we won't. I just did the math in my head. But we'll damn sure be in a lot better shape. PayPal button's at headonradionetwork.com, by the way. So is the snail mail address under the tab Contribute. No, Tracy mentioned something in the course of our conversation about Arizona and about the fact that, bless her, Gabby Giffords was a what was known as a blue dog, very pro-military. She is married to an astronaut, or a former astronaut, I suppose, Mark Kelly, shuttle astronaut. Former Congresswoman Giffords was not capable at the sentencing of Jared Lee Loeffner to offer a statement of victim's impact. Her husband, her devoted husband, who could probably tell General David Petraeus a thing or two about marital fidelity, we might add, offered the statement for her. And what a thing of gravitas it was. This is what he said, and it deserves to be read in full. Speaking directly to Jared Lee Loeffner, Mr. Kelly said, "Mr. Loeffner, for the first and last time, you are going to hear directly from Gabby and me about what you took away January the 8th, 2011, and just as important, what you did not. So pay attention. That bright and chilly Saturday morning, you killed six innocent people. Daughters and sons, mothers and fathers, grandparents and friends. They were devoted to their families, their communities, their places of worship. Gabby would trade her own life to bring back any one of those you savagely murdered on that day. Especially young Christina Taylor Green, whose high-minded ideas about service and democracy deserved a full life committed to advancing them. Especially 30-year-old Gabe Zimmerman, whom Gabby knew well and cherished, and whose love for his family and his fiancée and service to his country were as deep as his loss is tragic. Especially Judge John Roll, whom Gabby was honored to call a colleague and friend, and from whose interminable dedication to our community and country she gained enormous inspiration. Gabby would give anything to take away the grief you visited upon the Morrises, the Schnecks, and the Stoddards. Anything to heal the bodies and psyches of your other victims. And then there is what you took from Gabby. Her life has been forever changed. Plans she had for our family and her career have been immeasurably altered. Every day is a continuous struggle to do those things she was once so very good at. Gabby is a people person. She exudes kindness, creativity, and compassion. If she were not born with the name, Gabby, someone would have given it to her. Now she struggles to deliver each and every sentence. Her gift for language can now only be seen in internet videos from a more innocent time. Gabby was an outdoor enthusiast. She was often seen rollerblading with her friend Raul in Reed Park, hiking in Sabino Canyon, or careening down Rolito Wash Trail on her bike as she was the night before you tried and failed to murder her. She hasn't been to any of those places since, and I don't know when she'll return. There's more. Gabby struggles to walk. Her right arm is paralyzed. She is partially blind. Gabby works harder in 1 minute of an hour, fighting to make each individual moment count for something, than most of us work in an entire day. Mr. Loeffner, by making death and producing tragedy, you sought to extinguish the beauty of life, to diminish potential, to strain love, and to cancel ideas. You tried to create for all of us a world as dark and evil as your own. But know this, and remember it always. You failed. Your decision to commit cold-blooded mass murder also begs of us to look in the mirror. This horrific act warns us to hold our leaders and ourselves responsible for coming up short when we do, for not having the courage to act when it's hard, even for possessing the wrong values. We are a people who can watch a young man like you spiral into murderous rampage without choosing to intervene before it is too late. We have a political class that is afraid to do something as simple as have a meaningful debate about our gun laws and how they are being enforced. We have representatives who look at gun violence not as a problem to solve, but as the white elephant in the room to ignore. As a nation, we have repeatedly passed up the opportunity to address this issue after Columbine, after Virginia Tech, after Tucson, and after Aurora. We have done nothing. In this state, we have elected officials so feckless in their leadership that they would say, as in the case of Governor Jan Brewer,
"I don't think it has anything to do with the size of the magazine or the caliber of the gun."
She went on and said,
"Even if the shooter's weapon had fewer bullets, he'd have another gun, maybe. He could have three guns in his pocket."
She said this just 1 week after a high-capacity magazine allowed you to kill 6 and wound 19 others before being wrestled to the ground while attempting to reload. Or a state legislature that thought it appropriate to busy itself naming an official Arizona state gun just weeks after this tragedy occurred, instead of doing the work it was elected to do, encourage economic growth, help our returning veterans, and fix our education system. The challenges we face are so great, but the leadership in place is so often lacking. In so many moments, I find myself thinking, we need Gabby. In letter after letter, I've seen that others agree. As Americans mourned the 6 who died, they also mourned the loss of a representative who embodied the service they realized they should expect from those they elect, the type of person our country desperately needs to provide leadership and solve problems. Gabby was a courageous member of Congress, willing to stand up to the establishment when the establishment was wrong. She was thirsty for partnership across the aisle and was an unrelenting champion for her 600,000 constituents, one of which was you. There's something else Gabby and I have been spending a lot of time thinking about. The way we conduct politics must change. Sure, it's easier to win a debate if you can turn your opponent into a demon, but that's not how we move forward. Not only does slash-and-burn politics make Americans cynical about their leaders, but it leads to bad ideas. It creates problems instead of solving the ones we have now. Even amid all that was lost, Gabby and I give thanks for her life, her spirit, and her intellect, which are a continued force in this world despite what you've done. We exult in sharing our lives with each other and with our family and friends. As a city, Tucson has grown stronger. We love this community, and we love our neighbors. We are resilient, and the dynamism and compassion of our fellow Tucsonans will continue to push this city forward. And there is what persists in Gabby, her love for the city, this state, and this country, her commitment to lifting us all up and her ability to lead. Mr. Loeffner, you may have put a bullet through her head, but you haven't put a dent in her spirit and her commitment to make the world a better place. Mr. Loeffner, pay close attention to this. Though you are mentally ill, you are responsible for the death and hurt you inflicted upon all of us on January 8th of last year. You know this. Gabby and I know this. Everyone in this courtroom knows this. You have decades upon decades to contemplate what you did. But after today, after this moment, here and now, Gabby and I are done thinking about you. Sometimes when you read someone's honest, earnest words, you think that they immediately deserve forever a place in the pantheon of oratory. There's something about that speech that says that to me. And I wish Mr. Kelly would go all over the United States with that passage about feckless political leaders who cannot bear to even engage in a discussion about firearms in this country. We try to have that conversation here. We have it among ourselves. But good luck if you think you're going to have it on the larger national level. Because there is a significant portion of this country that is perfectly happy with our deal with the devil, as long as the 9-year-old who doesn't get to be a 10-year-old isn't theirs. So that's our program for this evening. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Thank you, all of you, who contribute to make sure that this all keeps going. Never forget that you are what keeps it going, and that you have a special place in the hearts of everyone for whom the horn is special, because you make it possible. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Sparky, also the moderator of our Horn Malloy Friday night Skype chat. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to Agnes. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT.org. ACHECT.org. Go there. Help us end mountaintop removal in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Here comes my buddy Rick Smith on the horn.